Now, this is one of three talks on finite density simulations of QCD on the lattice. And so this is definitely a hard problem. You heard Kei-Fei Liu yesterday, and you'll hear more from Simon. Here, I want to review the status of my collaboration with Ove Philipsen. And since this is a forward looking presentation, I'm going to talk also in the second part about future results, preliminary results obtained by my student. And since he wants to graduate in October, this is presumably not in the too distant future. So if you heat matter, then you're going to create pions out of thermal excitations. So your particles, your hadrons, which are initially very well separated, are going to be more and more densely packed. And the same thing happens if you compress matter, or equivalently, if you turn on a chemical potential which favors the creation of matter over antimatter. In all these cases, the hadrons, which were initially well-defined, separated objects, become more and more closer and closer to each other, and eventually they overlap. When this happens, it becomes ambiguous to decide to which hadron a given quark becomes, or even to decide whether color singlets are present or not in the theory. So the concept of confinement becomes fuzzy, becomes inappropriate in these regimes, and you expect some qualitative change to happen in the theory. So this is encoded in this phase diagram, which is the conjectured situation for real-world QCD, and you're familiar with all this confined phase, quark gluon plasma and color superconducting phase, and this notorious endpoint of the transition in the mu t plane, and this endpoint is the subject of intense experimental and theoretical searches. Now, this phase diagram is of course fully non-perturbative, so this is the area where numerical simulations play a leading role. And one key advantage of simulations versus the real world is you can change the parameters of your theory, and you can learn from these generalized versions of QCD what parameter influences what. Yes. Yes. Yes, definitely. This is on record, right? I have not read the full paper.
This is an NP group 4.
Right. Could be a cutoff effect.
Smaller than NP is the same, and larger as the increase NP.
Thank you for answering. Okay, so since you're free to vary the parameters of your theory in the real world, in your computer world, let's do that first of all at zero chemical potential. Then you can vary the up-down quark masses, which you take as equal, and the strange quark mass. And in these two corners, the massless limit and the infinitely massive limits, then you have well-defined symmetries. The center symmetry here, the chiral symmetry there, and the phase transition as a function of temperature is first order in both cases. So since it's first order, you can first order transition is robust against a small variation of parameters, so there's a whole region around this corner and that corner where the transition remains first order, but it becomes weaker. So eventually, the first order region is bounded by this blue line here, which is a line of second order transition points. And if you go outside this corner, then you have a crossover regime here in the middle. And same thing at the opposite corner. And now I'm going to show you results which, for the most part, have been obtained along this diagonal, which is the case where the three quark masses are equal. And notice, as you move along this diagonal, you go here from a first order regime to a crossover regime, so you cross the blue line at this particular red point, which I call MC. The quark mass is MC of mu equals 0. We're going to look at that in more detail. Now, this is the situation as a function of temperature at zero chemical potential. And you can complicate the story by turning on the chemical potential. Now, imagine an extra direction, the chemical potential coming out of the blackboard. And this blue line here becomes this red surface. Again, the up-down quark masses and the strange quark mass here. So this blue line becomes this red surface. And now if you start from a physical point, which presumably is around here, and turn on the chemical potential, then as a function of chemical potential, you're going to cross the red surface here. And this will be a second order point, the endpoint that we was describing in the previous figure. Now, no, the temperature is yet a fourth direction, and I have projected everything here in the two-dimensional plane and here in three dimensions. Right. Yes. And it corresponds, the temperature is adjusted so that you're at the transition point, of course. Again, there is a fourth coordinate here, which is the temperature, and I have projected everything onto here, three-dimensional space. So this point here corresponds also to an implicitly defined temperature. Yes, and then everything is projected back onto the two-dimensional plane. Exactly. The blue lines are the projection of this three-dimensional figure onto the two-dimensional plane here. And now I turn on an extra dimension, the chemical potential, still projecting all temperatures. No, it's a projection. Projection. Okay, that's what I said. Good. So, these two figures are the object of numerical determination by lattice simulations. And this one is relatively easy because it's at mu equals zero. This one is extremely hard because at non-zero chemical potential, you have a sign problem. So what does that mean? The Dirac operator for a given chemical potential mu satisfies this so-called gamma 5 hermeticity relation. Now, if you take the determinant on the left and on the right-hand side, gamma 5 is unitary. So you get a relationship between the determinant, the Dirac operator at chemical potential mu, and that at chemical potential minus mu star. If mu is zero, then it tells you the determinant is real. Also, if mu is pure imaginary, then this is equal to that. Again, you get a constraint that the determinant is going to be real. But otherwise, in general, for general mu, the determinant is not constrained to be real, so it will be complex, and then you cannot use this determinant as a measure for Monte Carlo sampling. That's the sign problem. Yes. That's correct. So to make life easy, you take an even number of flavors, and if you're motivated to study three flavors, then you take the absolute mu of this real object. It's a minor sin compared to, compared to other things you're going to do, because you know that in the continuum limit, this determinant is going to be positive. There's also a mass here which is non-zero, but it is a sin, yes. It's complex. I believe so. Let's move on here. So to tackle this sign problem, there's no magic bullet. What people have tried is to explore the regime of small chemical potentials. And that's already of phenomenological interest, because that's the regime where heavy ion collisions, these heavy ion collisions explore also. So there are three approaches on the market, and the best publicized one is the reweighting approach of Fodor and Katz. They simulate at zero chemical potential, where there's no sign problem, and then they reweight their results as a function of mu and beta, or temperature, along this critical line. There's a Taylor expanded version of the above, which Simon would presumably cover. And the third approach is the one I'm promoting, and it's being adopted by a gang of increasing size. So the virtues of this approach is you have no sign problem if you take an even number of flavors. And instead of simulating just at mu equals zero at this transition point, you can simulate at any non-zero imaginary chemical potential. So you can vary two parameters in your simulation, and you have completely uncorrelated results that you can analyze. And you have, in great part because of this, an increased control over systematics compared to the other approaches. So the idea is, again, you work at small chemical potential. You measure your observable as a function of imaginary mu, fit your results with a truncated Taylor series in mu imaginary over T, and then the analytic continuation of this polynomial is trivial. And this approach works well, provided you stay at small enough mu that the convergence of your Taylor series is fast, and we're going to see when that happens. So you have to choose a small mu and a smooth observable, an observable that varies smoothly with mu. So in general, the properties of the partition function as a function of mu over T is it's even, and it's periodic in imaginary mu. So this phase diagram as a function of imaginary mu has been worked out a long, long time ago, and this is what it looks like. So you have in this direction, imaginary mu, you have periodicity. So the phase diagram is repeated periodically, and this is just one period. So at low temperature here, you have the confining regime, and then at high temperature, you have deconfined regime with transitions here, which correspond to rotation of the Polyakov loop. The Polyakov loop for three colors has three different sectors, and here it's in the real sector, here it's one in one of the two rotated sectors. There'll be another transition here where it will rotate to the third sector and then come back, etc. And so you have here a first order transition, and there transition line separating the confined and the deconfined regime, and the order of the transition here depends on the parameters of the theory. In particular, for the three flavor theory, you can change the order of the transition depending on the quark mass. And this, we're going to take advantage of this. So if you look at the complex mu plane, then this transition here corresponds to this line there, and the phase of the Polyakov loop changes as you move up in the imaginary chemical potential direction. So you have a non-analyticity here, and you should, to be safe certainly, you should stay within this disk when you perform your analytic continuation. We assume that there are no additional singularities here in the complex plane. So this is the optimistic approach. Still, since the singularity is at pi over 3 in units of mu over pi t, that allows us to say something about the real chemical potential in a region where the baryon chemical potential reaches about 500 MeV, which is certainly of phenomenological interest.
Is there any pi over 3 because of the cost in the phase diagram?
Yes. We're limited because of this this line here. It doesn't, whether this is a cusp or not is not the issue. We're here, the Polyakov loop jumps from argument that the phase jumps from 0 to pi. Yes. In fact, I hear typically this solid line here is a first order transition which ends in a second order point, and here you have a crossover. So you don't have an order parameter, and the confined and deconfined regions are connected to each other. More questions? So the observable that we choose to study and analytically continue is the transition line itself. And the way we determine it is very standard. We consider local observables, the plaquette, the condensate, Polyakov loop, measure their susceptibilities, and in a finite volume, this susceptibility, instead of diverging, will have a peak, which implicitly defines the critical coupling as a function of, in our case, the imaginary chemical potential. So for various imaginary chemical potentials, we measure this pseudo-critical coupling, then we fit our results by this truncated Taylor expansion, and then we trivially rotate to real chemical potential. So what what should we expect? Well, the natural expansion parameter is mu over pi t. You can see that directly in perturbation theory, that the chemical potential enters in this dimensionless combination. You can also see it non-perturbatively because putting in an imaginary chemical potential amounts to having a phase shift for the fermionic fields at the Euclidean time boundary. So this phase shift introduces a shift for all Matsubara frequencies. So you should really compare this with pi t, the lowest fermionic Matsubara frequency. So again, non-perturbatively, this combination is what matters. Therefore, we expect in physical units our critical line to be parameterized by an expansion of this kind with coefficients here of order 1. And so the expansion will converge fast provided mu over pi t is small. So this is what we set out to do numerically. We did it for 2 flavors first, and then for 3 flavors. So these are the 3 flavor results. Here we show our pseudocritical coupling as a function of the imaginary chemical potential for 3 different volumes. There's a small finite volume effect, but otherwise the results are well parameterized by a polynomial which is almost a straight line. So you can see here that a truncation to order mu square is very good, and we can detect the small mu to the fourth correction, and in the end these are the coefficients in physical units, and you see that as expected they're of order 1. We can also measure the variation of this critical temperature with the quark mass, and again the coefficient is also of order 1. Since we work, you see by yourself, a straight line is a very good fit already. So it's a small measurable deviation. Now, to the order where we're working, in principle, we should also have seen a mu square m term, a cross term here, and it is absent, which we can explain in physical terms. Let's see that in a minute. Of what? All these simulations are done on lattices which have 4 time slices. So the corresponding lattice spacing is 0.3 Fermi, and anything that is presented in physical units should be taken with a big grain of salt. But if you give me a bigger computer, definitely, yeah. So one advantage of this imaginary chemical potential approach is you don't have a sign problem, so you're not limited in volume except by computer resources, which in my case forced me to work with the coarse lattices. So the same approach has been applied for other theories with different number of flavors, and this is a comparison of the dimensionless ratio T over TC, where TC is the mu equals 0 critical temperature, as a function of chemical potential. You see that the curvature increases as you increase the number of flavors. This is intuitively clear, and you can show actually straightforwardly that in the limit of large number of colors, this curvature should be proportional to NF, which is reasonably consistent with the measured curvatures here. Now, the result I just showed you for 3 flavors is the blue one. You can see that the technology is improving because this band, this error band limited by the 2 dotted lines, is very narrow, and also it includes the mu fourth term that you were wondering about. Whereas the other 2 only accurate to order mu square. So the mu fourth term has a very small effect here. Now, you can also compare our 3 flavor result, which is shown here as the black dotted line, with the results of Fodor and Katz obtained by reweighting. And so they reweighted from the simulation at numerical zero and varied the chemical potential, all from a single simulation. That's why their errors are so strongly correlated, the pink errors. But overall, there's excellent agreement between their results and ours, even though they have a completely different strange quark mass. And you can understand again that what matters is the ratio of the quark mass over pi t, minimum at the baryon frequency. So as long as this ratio is much less than one, it doesn't really matter what quark mass you take. And this is what we verify indirectly in this figure. The quark mass dependence is small. That's why also we couldn't measure any cross term of the form mu square m. Let's keep this. Let's say there's good consistency between this imaginary chemical potential approach and all other approaches as far as the critical line is concerned. So all methods agree. Now, we're trying to go beyond this and study this critical endpoint that's of such important value. So how do we do that? Again, we vary the quark mass. We stay in this three-flavor diagonal here and vary the quark mass. So if we take the quark mass to be mc of zero, then we have this second-order transition at mu equals zero. So in this phase diagram as a function of mu I, we have a second-order transition here at mu equals zero, and then the rest of this line is crossover. Now let me change the quark mass, make it a little bit smaller. So I move from here down into this first-order region. Then again, this first-order transition here at mu equals zero is robust. Again, small variation of the parameter. So I open a window in imaginary chemical potential over which the transition here will be first order. And this window ends with a second order point. And so the game here is to track the motion of this blue point as a function of the quark mass. Okay? And in I'm going to parameterize the motion of this blue point in terms of a truncated Taylor series. It's going to be truncated to just one non-trivial term because it's a hard problem. And so I expect in physical units, again, a coefficient here of order one. And you can argue that if I would put this quark mass all the way to zero, then I would have a real order parameter, and therefore I would need the confined and the deconfined phases would be disconnected from each other, which would only be possible if this first order line would go all the way to here. So this argument puts an upper bound on this coefficient. Now, numerically, how do things go? We need to detect, to identify this blue point. So we need to make the difference between a weakly first-order transition and a crossover, all this in a very small volume. That's an impossible task, of course. So we're doing our best, and the sensitive observable is the so-called Binder cumulant, which is a ratio of moments of the distribution of here the quark condensate. So this Binder cumulant in an infinite volume takes value 1 if you have a first order transition, because you just have a two, your distribution of psi bar psi is just the two delta functions, ordered and disordered. And in the case of a crossover, then you have a Gaussian distribution, the corresponding ratio of moments is 3. So you have a clear way of distinguishing the two, if provided your volume is very large. And at the second order point, the value of your Binder cumulant is determined by the universality class of your theory, which in our case is that of the 3D Ising model. And the corresponding value of the cumulant is that much. So we want to measure this Binder cumulant and identify the parameters where it takes this value. Now, this is to illustrate how difficult the problem is. This is our smallest quark mass, where the transition is the most strongly first order. And this is our largest quark mass, where the transition is most clearly crossover. And these are the plaquette distributions. You see that in both cases, you have a two-peak distribution. So the difference is, of course, that if you increase the volume, then this two-peak distribution becomes more pronounced here, and the peaks don't move. Whereas here, distribution tends towards the Gaussian. The two peaks come closer to each other, and the dip is maybe slightly smaller. But you see how difficult it's going to be to distinguish between this and that. And also, you need to have very good control over the tails and the suppression here in the middle. So you need extremely long simulations. It's the probability distribution. With some, actually, the normalization is correct. There's one. You're right. Yes. So here is a summary of all our results. We parameterize this Binder cumulant as the Ising value plus the leading effects in the Taylor expansion in the quark mass and the chemical potential, and we're after this coefficient A. And all the results for all our chemical imaginary chemical potentials are well parameterized with this lowest order polynomial, from which the value of A translates into this coefficient, which is of order 1, as expected, but has about a 40% error. Now, this looks innocuous, but what it means is that you have a very high sensitivity of mu over the quark mass. If I change this a little bit away from 1, then this is going to change quite a bit. Mu is going to change quite a bit because it's divided by pi t. The whole thing is squared. We're going to see exactly how much. Now, our results are in agreement, for MC of 0, are in agreement with the literature. And this coefficient C1, which we measure to be that much, has been estimated also by this Bielefeld-Swansea collaboration. The value, you take the numbers, is much, much greater, and it also conflicts with the upper bound 9 that I mentioned before. On the other hand, you can also say that both results are consistent within 2 sigmas, and also consistent with 0. So this is a hard game to play. And all of this is on a very coarse lattice anyway. So yeah, we also compared several lattice sizes and put all of this together, and there's a nice finite size scaling plot. Okay. The point that I wanted to make is, let's suppose that the critical endpoint in real-world QCD, it has this value. This is the value that Fodor and Katz proposed in their most recent study. Then translated in terms of quark mass divided by MC of 0, this means we're between 1 and 1.05. So if you change the quark mass away from this value by just 5%, you move the endpoint from mu equals 0 to mu equals 120 MeV. So a 5% change in the quark mass moves the endpoint all the way from 0 to here. So you can turn the argument backwards. If nature has chosen the endpoint to be at small values of mu, then it means the quark mass has been carefully chosen to be very near this value, within just a few percent. So there's an issue of fine-tuning. If you would close your eyes and choose in the plane of quark masses some random value, generically the corresponding endpoint of that theory would be very far from mu equals zero, would be at mu of order 500 MeV or so. Yes? Of course, the temperature is always implicitly fixed so that you are at the critical point. Yes. Okay, so all this was on the three flavor theory. Now let me give an outlook on what we're doing. We've been doing the last year. We take non-equal masses for the up, down, and strange. So we're actually exploring this plane and trying first to identify this blue line numerically. That's at mu equals zero. And this is a summary of our results. The red points is what we have obtained, and qualitatively they look a lot like what you would expect. There are several interesting comments. The green line is the three-flavor line. The scales are different, that's why it looks so flat. So our three-flavor theory that we are looking at before was along here, and this is the point MC of zero. If you try to make a linear guess of this critical line away from this point, you would get it wrong. So you have to be careful about non-linearities here. Another comment is that these two crosses are the two determinations of the critical point by Fodor and Katz, first for heavy masses and more recently for realistic quark masses. And so they confirm the argument that I was presenting a minute ago, that in order to get a critical point at small values of mu, which they do here, you need to choose your quark masses very close to this blue line here, which is here. So they're about 10% away from the critical line at mu equals zero. And the systematic errors on the quark masses that you use are certainly of order 5 or 10%. If you just consider the electromagnetic mass difference between the pi plus, pi minus, and pi zero, that by itself generates a 5 or 6% change in the up-down quark masses. And another interesting aspect is our results can be compared with the predictions of tricritical point here. If there is such a tricritical point consistent with O4 scaling, then you know the exponents, the critical exponents in the vicinity of that point because they're mean field. And so you can try to fit your data with such a critical curve, and you see the fit is quite consistent. And the corresponding value of the tricritical mass is rather heavy. Of course, yes. And their cutoff effects are tremendous, and we have staggered fermions here. So this is a summary of 1 year of computer simulations, and now we want to repeat it at non-zero mu, so that we can see how much this blue line changes as we turn on the chemical potential. Okay, this was part one. Part two is the future, or the near future. We work in the canonical ensemble, and what I'm going to say has a lot of similarities with what Kefei presented yesterday. So if you want to fix the baryon number, you have this delta function for this conserved charge here. You can express the delta function as a Fourier integral. Then what comes out is that your canonical partition function is just the Fourier transform of your grand canonical partition function at imaginary chemical potential. So this you know how to sample, and then you have to take the Fourier transform, which of course contains the sign problem. However, here, the only part of the measure that depends on the chemical potential is the determinant. And this determinant you can Fourier transform exactly. You diagonalize this matrix, you do exactly the same thing that Fodor and Katz have been doing, but instead of reweighting to real mu, you extract all the Fourier coefficients. In one shot, you extract all the Fourier coefficients for as a function of imaginary mu. So you do a sampling at some imaginary chemical potential of your choice, I mu mc, and then you measure the canonical partition function at baryon number B, normalized by your Monte Carlo partition function, as an observable. So your observable now is this expression here, where the blue part is computed exactly on each configuration of your ensemble. So performing this computation exactly is expensive. This is how much work it takes, where LS is the number of sites in the spatial direction, LT in the Euclidean time. You see that you can go to low temperatures for very cheap. So this is a good approach for low temperature. Now, you have a sign problem, of course. It's just a different systematics than the other ways that people have tried. But the sign problem now appears in this observable. So your estimate of this ZC, which of course is positive, the estimate can be negative, can fluctuate. But instead of having a sign problem which grows exponentially badly with the volume, now the sign problem is governed by the baryon number. So you can go to large volumes, and the seriousness of the sign problem does not get worse. It's the baryon number that matters. You can turn it the other way. As you increase the volume, keeping B fixed, then your density B over V goes to zero. So in the end, your physics is zero density. Yes. So you can say this is uninteresting. However, it's zero density, but just a few baryons. And imagine looking at two baryons in a large box. Then you can look at deuteron or at. It's a cheat in the sense that you don't study the original problem that you set out to do, which was high density. But nevertheless, there are a lot of extremely interesting problems that you can consider, because you just have a few baryon system, and you can learn a lot about nuclear physics, even if not about finite density. In principle, yes. In practice, it's so difficult that people have not succeeded in 20 years. One reason is you have many diagrams, including so-called disconnected diagrams, and you need to compute them all. Right, and here you have the full answer. Okay, so you're right. So to go to 20 Fermis, you just have to pay the price here. It's not exponential. That's the issue. It's only a power 9. Okay. So there is a potentially an overlap problem that this ensemble here has little to do with that ensemble there. And this was recognized by Kefe yesterday. Our approach is just to do the best we can, combine several ensembles, and see if our results tend to break down as a function of volume or as a function of a baryon number. And in our pilot study, we have staggered fermions, relatively sufficiently light to have interesting physics. The lattice is very coarse. And we have four flavors for to simplify the technical issues, four degenerate flavors, which in this case means that the transition between confined and deconfined is expected to be first order at all chemical potentials. So the results, Our observable, again, is the partition function in a given baryon sector. So we express this in terms of the free energy in units of temperature. So this quantity, free energy per baryon, is expressed here as a function of beta, or the temperature, for 4 cube and 6 cube lattice. And you see clearly the effect of the phase transition. Above beta C, here, we have this quark gluon plasma. Essentially, nothing changes with temperature. We have a gas of free fermions, massless fermions, and we're going to verify these ansatz in more detail in the next transparency. Things are different in the low temperature confined phase. And here you can see at low temperature that the free energy per baryon is almost the same no matter how many baryons you pile up. There's a slight repulsion here. And also the free energy doesn't change much with temperature as you lower it, which means you almost have isolated the ground state. This is quite conceivable since your box is very small. So the box is so small that the first non-zero spatial momentum is very high, and it's not excited at the temperatures that we consider. The same thing qualitatively happens on the larger box. You can also see that numerically it's more difficult. However, we still have 13 fermions here at temperatures which are about 90% of TC. 13 baryons, I'm sorry. The observable is this, which is the free energy normalized, which is the partition function normalized to sum up. And what we actually measure is the free energy per baryon. So we compare this with the same thing for a different B, different baryon number. We have many observables of this type for different baryon sectors. And we compare. No, it's the logarithm of can you see? the partition function baryon sector B divided by that at zero baryon, and then we take log of that. Right? And in fact, I just took the log and showed the free energy in units of temperature. Thank you. So these were the results. Now, we can, since we know the free energy, we know everything about the system, we can get the equation of state. We can, in particular, try to go back to the Grand Canonical Ensemble and obtain the chemical potential versus density. So one way would be to use this fugacity expansion. However, this is like a discrete Laplace transform. It's notoriously unstable with respect to a little bit of noise. And so we do not want to do that. And this is actually the essential difference between what we do and an older proposal, an older paper by Anna Hasenfratz and Doug Toussaint. They take almost identical steps to what we did, but then they try to implement this Laplace transform and they get noise. So they concluded that this method did not work. I think this is too bad for them, because if instead you use a saddle point approximation, then you can express your grand canonical partition function as this exponential of free energy density and the chemical potential term, where rho, and you integrate over rho, the density, then the saddle point gives you relationship between chemical potential and the derivative of the free energy density, which you can now express in a discrete version as this. Free energy of baryon sector B plus 1 minus that of baryon sector B. And this is, this quantity here is plotted here in units of temperature as a function of baryon number. This is just above, 10% above TC. And this, the red is our data going up to 30 baryons, and the green is the answer for a free massless gas. In free massless gas, you have your free energy just mu squared plus mu fourth. It stops there, and the coefficients are known except for cutoff effects, which we parameterize. So with these two parameters, we describe exactly, essentially, our results 10% above TC. Now, so we have evidence that 10% above TC, we have our quark gluon plasma is well described by free massless gas. Now let's keep that green curve, I show it here, the same one, and lower the temperature. Now I'm 10% below TC, and these are our results. So you can see that if my baryon density is high enough, then I recover the quark gluon plasma, the free massless quark ansatz. But if I'm at very small baryon number, then I'm on a completely in a completely different regime in the confined phase. And then it doesn't take too much imagination to see that, here you have coexistence. So as you change your baryon number, your proportion of confined and deconfined, your mixture of confined and deconfined phases changes, keeping the chemical potential constant. So as you move from here to there, you progressively become deconfined. And this blue curve is the hadron resonance gas ansatz. There's only one free parameter which we adjusted here. So I would say this method works reasonably well at these temperatures on lattices which people have come up to consider as almost serious. Yes. But yeah, it is the same, except of course the volume is smaller, so the transition, the plateau here, is much shorter, and it's more difficult to convince people that there is a plateau. Yes, on the 6-cube lattice. In fact, the green curve here is parameterized from this high temperature data. It's a fit. You know that there are lattice cutoff effects, and these cutoff effects can be calculated exactly in the free theory, but not in the interacting theory. So we have introduced two coefficients. There are two terms, mu square and mu fourth in the free energy. We have correspondingly introduced two coefficients. One comes out to be 0.97 instead of one for the free theory. So there's a small correction. And the other one comes out to be 1.3 instead of one again for the free theory. So there are small corrections due to interactions. But they're completely normal. It's not a free massless gas. It's a weakly interacting massless gas. So that is the green curve, which is unchanged at this lower temperature. Now, let's lower the temperature. We do this first on the 4-cube lattice. And now, this was again the behavior. This is the free energy per baryon. And this was again the behavior in the deconfined phase, and all these colored points correspond to successively lower temperatures. What you see is there's a dip here. The scale has been set by specifying the critical temperature to be 160 MeV. So for one baryon, the free energy comes out to be about a GeV in the right ballpark. And then if you add a second baryon to your system, the free energy decreases. And a third baryon, it decreases further until about 5 or 6 baryons, and that's the minimum free energy. So you really have evidence for attraction among your baryons. And you also have evidence that lowering the temperature has very little influence. Here we went down to about 50 MeV temperature, one-third of TC. and we have pretty much isolated the ground state already at 100 MeV. It's 0.05 in lattice units, so the 20 years ago, this was the standard for full QCD simulation. And people did spectroscopy using these values. I'm sorry, I don't have in my head the pion mass, but maybe 400 MeV. I'm not sure. This was considered light, yeah, at the time. Yes. 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 Well, if you increase the temperature, so this temperature range is in the vicinity of TC, let's say 10% above or below, and in that range of temperature, you see that there is repulsion. The free energy per baryon is a little bit more than the free energy of one baryon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's an issue of size, of course, and so. I'm sorry. Right, the lattice size is about 1.2 Fermi. Right, these are four flavor. A practical answer to your question is, let's increase the box size and see what happens. So this is the current status. So the box now is 6 cube, 1.8 Fermi on the side, and the temperature is 2/3 of TC. And again, you see this dip, and the minimum corresponds to about 10 baryons. So the persistence of this attraction is there. Let me conclude. Yes. So the first part of the talk points to the possibility of really doing a continuum chiral extrapolation for this transition line. This I think is quite realistic. The determination of the endpoint, on the other hand, is still very exploratory. Cutoff effects have to be very large, and moreover, the quark masses have to be chosen very carefully. They have a big influence on the location of this point. The second part is let's change our perspective. Instead of struggling to determine this phase diagram at high density, let's maybe look at just a few baryons and see how they interact. Thank you.